tonight. This evening, we're going to be picking up in verse 2 and continuing on. I wanted to give a little bit of an explanation as to why we're spending so much time on this. This particular subject has been the main reason why we've seen the apostasies in the church. It always seems to start with church autonomy and church leadership, and then it quickly grows into a situation where we now have a new organization or a new group of people who are involved in it. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to spend so much time. The better we understand this, and the more we understand about the church and the work of the church and especially the government of the church, I hope we never forget the example that we gave last week, which is that when Israel asked for a king, they put a layer between God and themselves. And the first opportunity with Jeroboam drove the whole nation into apostasy. And that's exactly what happened with the Catholic Church, and that's exactly what has happened with these church organizations that have come ever since. So wanted to spend some time on it, and not going to spend much time on the first two pages because they're basically right out of the eldership book, but I wanted to have them in my notes. I do want to spend a little bit of time on page 2, however, with this middle section where we see the fact that in the context of Acts chapter 20 and in the context of 1 Peter chapter 5, it's the same office. Catholic Church have bishops, and they have elders or shepherds, and they have separated them out into different groups. But Paul made it very clear when he calls for the elders in verse 17, and they come to him, he says to them that God made you the overseers or bishops, and that they were to shepherd. So, again, I don't think we'll spend a whole lot of time on this because we've done it quite a bit in the past. So let's just jump into this term overseer, or as the English ultimately they translate it with the term bishop. Most of the later translations, I think after the American Standard, they all went to overseer, because that's a more literal definition, or excuse me, yes, a more literal translation, because the Greek word, that's literally what it means. Epi means upon, and skopos means to look. So to look upon, to oversee, to watch over is the basic meaning behind the term. One of the difficulties of this word is it's not used in the Old Testament at all. It's used sporadically of different offices, but it's not an office in the church, or excuse me, in the Old Testament. So we have to rely completely how it was used in the Greek. So if we turn to page 3, right up at the top, we see that the Greeks used it as for an inspector, taskmaster, captain, resident. And essentially, this was a group of people who watched over and took care of the needs that were under them, whether it was a municipal occupation or whether it was a foreman or a superintendent in a secular occupation. Their job was to watch over what people were doing and make sure they were doing it right. And that's really the perfect explanation of what the term overseer means in the New Testament. And once again, it's only used of the elders. It's only used of those who are functioning as shepherds. On the middle of page 3, we see that serving as overseers is actually a verb. This is not a noun like the overseer itself, but this is the occupation or the work of the overseer. And it's only used one other time in the New Testament, and that's found at the bottom of page 3, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. So we are all overseers in the capacity of making sure that we don't fall short of the grace of God. We have a responsibility. The grace of God is not something that we can take for granted. We have to oversee that grace and make sure we don't come short of it. But go ahead and turn to page 4. in those two passages toward the top of the page, we talk about being an overseer. Well, a shepherd is an overseer. And so God condemns the shepherds in Ezekiel because they didn't strengthen the weak. They should have. They should have been overseeing. When they saw the weak, they should have strengthened. You didn't heal the sick. They should have been. They should have been noticing that the sheep were sick, and they should have healed them. You didn't bind up the broken or bring back what was driven away. They should have if they had been watching, but they didn't. You didn't seek what was lost, but with force and cruelty, you have ruled over them. So the main purpose and function of the overseer is to assess those who are weak, those who are sick, those who are broken, those who have been driven away, those who are lost, and to bring them back, to watch over and take action. And I'll make this one more comment, then we'll kind of open it up for any questions or comments you might have. But in the very middle of page 4, God made Ezekiel a watchman. And in verse 18, it says, "When I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand." And I think that's really the basic understanding, is that the elders are going to give an account. You see in Hebrews 13, verse 17, right underneath this verse, "Obey those who rule over you. They watch for your souls as those who must give an account." So these shepherds in Ezekiel, toward the top of the page, when they didn't strengthen the weak, when they didn't heal the sick, when they didn't bind up the broken or bring back what was driven away, God was going to hold them accountable, because they should have. And so in the New Testament church, we'll get into this more a little bit later, but in the New Testament church, God has decreed or determined that there shall be shepherds over every church, and those shepherds are watching in behalf of the souls, and they're going to give an account, and so they are the watchmen. All right, anybody want to make any comments on this the nature of an overseer and what his role is? Okay, well, as I say, this is really basic information. I'm sure you've heard it over and over and over again. So let's
Alan,
go ahead and... Yes,
Alan,
sir?
Yeah, it took a few minutes to get our set up. This is a good point that you're bringing out here. Because so many times, and I've seen this over the years, when a qualification for elders come around, it has not really much evidence placed upon the man being able to perceive what is actually happening and to be able to identify it and to take and work and teach against it if it's error. And what he's normally looked at is, how good of a businessman is he? How good does he get along with everybody? And, you know, so forth. It's not really what needs to be the attributes of a good shepherd.
Yeah, that's a good point. A leader is not necessarily a leader unless he knows what he's leading them into.
That's it.
If you've got a guy who can lead in making watches or a lead in digging ditches, it doesn't mean he's going to know how to bring back the sick and the weak and the fallen and the broken and help them. So that's what those qualifications are for.
Yeah.
And I think that's critical for two reasons. I've made this point through the years. First of all, it protects the sheep. Those qualifications protect the sheep from people who won't be able to lead them properly, but it also protects the man. Because if you get appointed to an eldership and you're not qualified and you don't do the work, then you're going to have to give an account, and you could lose your soul when you might not have lost your soul if you hadn't taken the responsibility you just weren't qualified to do. So that's another aspect of this.
Well, it appears to me that the early elders that were addressed, that the falling away would take place and it would happen right within their midst, to begin with anyway. I have serious doubts as to whether they really understood or knew what was really coming down.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what they were faced with.
Well, there has to be some perception on the elders to be able to take a look and understand, you know, as to what is happening. The smallest minuscule of digression from God's word is the first stepping stone. We use the term, when the barn door is open, the horse gets out. And that's true. So the idea of that is to keep the barn door closed, I guess.
Yes.
But anyway,
that's absolutely.
Just some thoughts.
Appreciate it. Anybody else?
Yeah, Alan. Let me ask a question here. As appointed to elders, you know, is that part of, like, if you in a position of some kind of program or something like that? Let's say that maybe Beth Ministry, or if you some of it, like food drives and things like that, and you're the elder or something like that, is that really something that should be considered being an elder's position, or just what?
Well, of course, the primary function for the eldership is to oversee the souls of the people who are over them. When it comes to the work of the church, certainly they're the ones who would appoint the work that would be done and then get the deacons and the brethren to be behind it. The two illustrations that you have given would be illustrations, I think, of things that would be, I think, a little bit iffy. I mean, I guess you could put bus ministry under the idea of evangelism. But the good deeds, I think the church is, or the Lord has left that up to individuals, and it's not something the elders, I think, would be, you know, involved in very much. I don't think elders need to be involved in the personal lives of the brethren, only in the spiritual lives of the brethren, and of course as their spiritual life crosses over into their physical life, they would be involved. Does that answer your question, Charles, or were you
yes, it does answer the question and everything, you know, but sometimes, you know, there are situations, you know, will come up, okay, and someone will say, okay, well, we need an elder in charge of this field or whatever, and you know, which include, you know, other things. And my thought was, you know, the souls of it, even though you can look at that in a sense, there are souls. Okay, let's say bus ministry or something like that. Okay, people need to get to work, I mean, get to church or whatever. But then there also, too, the individuals can also, you know, act in that behalf also, too. As well, we don't have to really put a lot of emphasis in doing that, you know, because there might be times when people can't drive, you know, across whatever, so.
Right. No, I would agree with that. I think that so many times elders get involved in administrative activities, and it takes them away from the very thing they were appointed to be elders for, and that is to oversee and take care of the needs of the sheep. And when you've got the sheep involved in activities that are inappropriate, then that takes away from what the elders are supposed to be doing. I tend to agree with you. I've very seldom seen a church that was so overwhelmed with people wanting to come that they needed to buy a bus. I can't say that's never happened, but for the most part, I think churches would be better served by having individuals pick them up. That way you have contact, and I think that's a much more scriptural, much more expedient way to go about it. But yeah, you made one point that I think is concerning, and that is if we appoint an elder over something, I think that all the elders need to be aware of all the things that all the other elders are involved in. Otherwise, it's not an eldership. So, you know, you don't appoint an elder over one specific thing. The elders are responsible for that. And so they all need to be involved in it. At least that's my understanding. Does that help, Charles?
Yes, that helps, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, on the bottom of page 4, we're now going to get into the motivations behind the elders. And again, from one perspective, since most of us are not going to be elders, we could look at this more as this is what God expected of the elders, and that is, but I think that the basic principle would be true of all of us, and that is everything that we're asked to do should not be by compulsion, but it should be willingly. And so this is the heart and the motivation of what we're doing. We shouldn't come to church services out of compulsion because we know somebody's going to call us or we know that problems are going to come. We should be willingly going to services. And Paul says the same thing. Don't give grudgingly or out of necessity. Don't give by compulsion, but because God loves a cheerful giver. So give willingly. And so when we jump now over to page 5, we see that the word literally means by force or constraint. And I think it perfectly illustrates what God was condemning in those people that were shepherds in the time of Ezekiel. They ruled with force and rigor. They demanded things of the sheep, but they didn't take care of the sheep. And so we need to realize something, and that is that all of the commands that God has given, he wants us to see them as opportunities, not as obligations. I like that passage. I preached a few lessons on it in Psalms 110 on the top of page 5. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. We all know that that's talking about Christ. But then in verse 3, he says, your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power. And so God wants to see willingness. He wants to see the definition here of the word volunteers is uncompelled and free movement of the will. I don't have to do this. I want to do it. I don't feel compelled to do this. It's a privilege to do it. It's an honor to do it. And that's how Christians are supposed to feel. We happily volunteer. And so that's what David encouraged Solomon to do. See at the bottom, toward the bottom of page 5. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him with a loyal heart, with a willing mind. And so this is, you know, I think the first step toward apostasy is when we are no longer doing this willingly, voluntarily, cheerfully, and happily, but we feel obligated. We feel compelled. The very nature of feeling compelled would mean that we've lost, maybe perhaps even left our first love. We're no longer doing it out of love. We're doing it out of responsibility. And when God called to Isaiah, he said, who will I send and who will go for us? He didn't command Isaiah to go. He asked him who wanted to go. And he said, here am I, send me. And so the responsibility here falls to us to want to keep God's will. I like that passage in Deuteronomy where it says that God has given all of these commands for our good always. And so if we realize that and we believe that all these commands are for our own good, then we're not going to feel compelled. We're going to feel honored. And I think that that's really important. And I kind of draw from that that's right. It's right in the middle of page 5. This is one of the stark differences between the Old and the New Covenants. Under the law, Israel didn't have a choice. They were born into a covenant, and they had to keep it. And most of them never learned how to want to keep it. So under the New Law, under the New Covenant, God says, I'm only going to take volunteers so that everyone who comes into my kingdom will have my laws in their mind. And no one will have to say, know the Lord, because they'll all know me. Well, why will they all know him? Because under the law, under the new covenant, we volunteer. God says, go into all the world, preach the gospel. He that believes and is baptized will be saved. That's voluntary. We either choose to do that or we don't. And so the same thing is true with these elders here. We need to get away from this sense of obligation. But not just for the elders, as I say, since we don't have elders, I decided to kind of run this out a little bit so that it could include all of us. We all have commands and responsibilities, and it's very dangerous whenever a command starts feeling like an obligation and not as a privilege. And I think that happens when the cares of this world and the desires of other things choke out the word. It happens when the lust starts gaining control and we feel hemmed in and frustrated because we can't do what we want to do. So it's a dangerous thing, and we need to be aware of it. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, middle of page 6, not for dishonest gain. Now, I've got some definitions here, and I really like the third one, which says not using your position for personal gain. And it doesn't refer exclusively to material desires, but it can also be gaining popularity. It can also be taking advantage of people, getting power over people. I think it's something Paul said when he said they try to draw away the disciples after themselves. They want to use the disciples. Like God told those people in Ezekiel, you eat the sheep. You muddy the water. You eat the sheep. You don't feed the sheep. You don't care about the sheep. You're only doing this for what you can get. And I think Jesus condemned the Sadducees and Pharisees for the same thing. They didn't care about the sheep. They just used the sheep for chief place in the marketplace, chief places at the in the synagogues, and to be called by man, rabbi, rabbi. They wanted it for things that were not honest. That's not the reason why somebody becomes or puts themselves into the position of being an elder. But this is a problem that all service industries, I remember when I was an ambulance driver, we were told very strongly, regardless of how thankful the people are, do not accept any money from them. Do not accept anything from them. Just say, thank you, we were just doing our jobs. And I think that there's a reason behind that. When people are helped, they are grateful. And when they're helped spiritually, they're grateful. But once you start taking things from people for spiritual benefits, it's a downward spiral. And so we just never want to find ourselves in a situation where we do that, and these elders, the same thing. We do not want elders who have other motivations than caring for the sheep and loving the sheep and overseeing the sheep and doing the work that God has given the elders to do, so that the church is a safe haven for God's people, where the wolves are taken care of, and the weak are taken care of, and the broken, and those who wander away, they're all taken care of. And we can't have the wrong motivations. That's going to cause some serious issues. All right, anybody have any thoughts on this dishonest gain? Okay. Eagerly and willingly are kind of two peas in a pod. They're actually synonyms, except eagerly has a much more powerful component to it. I think that those of you who know anything about the original language, you know that the Greek word thumos, from which the word epithumeo or epithumos, which is human lust, comes from. The thumos is a very passionate, powerful part of our being. And so here we have the word prothumos, which means pushing forward the thumos onto this particular activity. In other words, I want to be passionate about it. I want to be interested in it. I want to be eager and wake up in the morning. What can I do today? Are there any sheep that have any needs today? Is there anything that I can do today? So shepherds are to exercise the oversight willingly, joyfully, and passionately. In other words, this is something they want to do. This is something they're happy to do. I mean, we've all read about doctors who are truly interested in their patients, and we've also met doctors who have been doing it for so long that it's only a way to make money now. They don't really care about the sheep. I'm sorry about the sheep. About the patients. So eagerly is a motivation that And I think this is something that needs to be assessed by the men who want to be elders before they start. Like I said, some people want to be elders because they don't really understand what it entails. It is a grave responsibility. We have to give an account of every person, and it can't be something that we wish we hadn't started, because it's overwhelming. And those who have served as elders, you know how overwhelming it can be. You've got to be the one to go out and deal with all the problems, and you've got to be the one that makes sure that all the needs of the saints are taken care of. And so it needs somebody who's eager, who's passionate and intense about it. All right. Any thoughts on the eagerness and the willingness and the passion that we ought to have? And again, I don't think this is just true for elders. I think that, you know, before you become an elder, you have to be a Christian. And if you haven't cultivated these things throughout your Christian life, for example, personal evangelism, is that a responsibility? Is that something we do by compulsion, or is that something we want to do? Is it something we're passionate about? Is it something we're excited about? When brethren sin, are we interested? Are we eager to go out and try to help them, try to take care of it? Or does it become a grudging obligation? Well, they've fallen away. I guess I better go out and see them because somebody's got to do it. I guess I'm going to have to be the one. And so, like I say, you can't be an elder until you've already been doing a lot of the work of the eldership. And like I say, in our congregation, since we don't have elders, we're all responsible for these things. And we ought to be eager and passionate about it, about bringing back the sick and the weak and the broken and the people who are lost, and going out there and doing these things. So this isn't something you just turn on after you become an elder. It's something that you had turned on. You felt that way your whole life as a Christian. And now, because you've raised your family because of this eagerness, because you have developed all the qualifications because of this eagerness, now we can seamlessly move into the eldership, because it's no different than what we've always been doing. But if somebody says, well, when I become an elder, I'll become more passionate about this, I'll become more interested, well, it doesn't work that way. This has to come naturally from the heart. It has to be voluntary and passionate and exciting. All right.
Alan?
Okay, verse 3 kind of falls in line with what I've been writing my bulletin articles on for the last 5 weeks, and what we've been talking about in our sermons, which is that Christians are the greatest in the kingdom of heaven are servants. Virgil, were you about to comment? I see your microphone.
Yep.
Did I run over you?
Yeah, but it didn't come through for some reason. I don't know why. But
okay,
the point. Go ahead.
So serving, leading, are synonymous terms in the scriptures. Whatever role you have as a Christian, whether you're husband, wife, mother, father, co-worker, boss, employee, makes no difference. President of the United States, makes no difference. If you're a Christian, you're there to serve the people who you've been put over. You are not a lord. You don't lord it over people. You don't use our position of authority to gain anything. We don't use it to gain power. We don't use it to gain financial advantages. We don't use it to gain psychological advantages. The Lord has no place in the church, has no place in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, those among the Gentiles, they do this. Matter of fact, this is the same term that he uses. If you turn to page 8, you'll see right at the top, Jesus called them and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Not so shall it be among you. So whether you're an overseer, or an elder, or a shepherd, or a Bible class teacher or a preacher, husband or wife, only rulers of the Gentiles try to take the position of authority over. In the Lord's kingdom, we see ourselves as servants. And so, and that's the point Paul makes in Ephesians chapter 5 when he says in verse 21, subjecting yourselves or submitting one to another in the fear of Christ. So the relationships, human relationships, we are all servants regardless of the position we have. Husbands are supposed to be like Christ, loving their wives and taking care of their needs, so they're serving them. And fathers are supposed to be training up their children, the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and so they're serving their children. So there's no such thing as authority in the Lord's kingdom. The only authority comes from Christ, from God, and from the Scriptures. The rest of it is just our submission and the relationships. And as I said, I made this point in my last article. We'll never understand how to turn the other cheek. We'll never understand how to be wronged until we understand this concept of none of us are lords. None of us are in a position where other people should be looking up to us or treating us with some kind of respect. That's something that we struggle with, but it's something that we need to get rid of, because these men, they cannot exercise lordship. They can exercise authority from the Scriptures, just like a preacher. Preacher can exercise authority by preaching the word, but he doesn't have any innate authority, and neither do the elders. It's not a position where your personality or your personal attributes give you the ability to rule over or force people to do. Matter of fact, if we have to force Christians to be Christians, they're not going to be saved anyway. There's just no purpose or value to forcing people to do the things that you want them to do, even as an elder. We cannot function as a lord, because that's not part. We can do it by example. We'll spend a little more time on that in just a second. Anybody want to weigh in on this idea of lordship?
I got a couple of thoughts on this, Alan. In the society that we live in.
Okay, well, let's take just a minute. I'm going to take a break here between the thoughts, because there's a direct parallel between not lording and being an example. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about this term. It's on the middle of page 8, and that is those entrusted to you.
Hey, Alan, are you not hearing us? Or
I kind of struggle with this, because the literal definition...
Maybe Jeannie can tell him that he can't hear us. I don't know.
Casting lots. Matter of fact, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it says that the soldiers cast lots for the garment of Jesus. And that's what the word means here. I mean, it's the Greek word for lot. And so they look at this, and I don't... Jeannie just came in and said Virgil's trying to make a comment, and I didn't hear it. I did not hear it. Virgil, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, can you hear me now? Alan, can you hear me?
Yeah, he might not. He might have come unplugged or something, because he's not getting any comments, I don't think. You're hearing him.
Okay, I've got him now. I have no idea what happened, but my speakers were turned off. So I'll just sit back and let everybody catch up on their comments. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know how many was trying to get through to me, but anyway, can you hear me now?
I can hear you perfectly, Virgil, and I'm really sorry I didn't hear you before.
Don't feel sorry about that. Things come unplugged.
It's a mechanical error.
No, it's what I was... One of the things that I just wanted to add to this. Well, when we look at the society that we live in, one of the marks of success seems to be how competitive that we are. And I realize that competitiveness does mean something in our lives. I'm not trying to diminish it at all. But when we start working within the kingdom and working with brethren, a lot of that competitiveness needs to go by the wayside and recognize that the primary enemy we got is the devil and his works, and be actively working to take and expose him and what he's trying to do. Doesn't make any difference who throws the ball the furthest or who can get the most people together around him or who's the best of this or the best of that. That shouldn't be part of it. Now, we still live in a real world, and people have a tendency to want to migrate towards things like that, and that's just the way that it is. But I feel that people that's in the leadership role within the kingdom need to understand these traits and to be able to try to work so that it does not affect the outcome or the work that we're trying to do in the kingdom and preach the word, help people that are in need of help, spiritual and physical, and things of that nature. But it's a difficult thing to hold down that competitiveness or the desire to be up in front and just, you know, to talk. And I'm probably one of the world's worst for that, and I'll, you know, I just say that up front. But if I am, I fight it all the time. I don't want to be that way because I know that it's no good. And the greatest leaders that we read of in the scriptures, a lot of times we would look at them as being meek in the sense of being weak, but that's not true.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll be quiet.
No, that's an excellent point, Virgil, and it's something that can't be said enough. All of us need to give real careful consideration to, you know, pride and arrogance and self-esteem. They all kind of mingle together, and if somebody steps on us and we feel like they have done that, it's tough. And so, especially with elders are going to get the brunt. They're going to get hit a lot. And somebody once said, and I think it's true, I think one of the reasons God likes the analogy of sheep is you can't drive sheep. You have to have them follow you. And that's where Peter's going here is we need to be examples. We don't need to be people who are lording it and forcing people. We're people who show other people how to do it, and then they want to follow. And so I think that's the point you're making, Virgil.
Yeah.
Anything else on that before we...
No, I don't have anything else on it. There's part of the that I forgot about it or what I was going to say, but others probably has a better explanation than what I do.
Well, I don't know about that. Probably as good as, but I'm not sure about better. But anybody else? Did I step on anybody? Did I not hear your comments? Is there anything we need to go back and cover again or talk about? Okay, well, my speakers are working, and I didn't hear anybody's. Okay, then. Let's talk about this charge or charge allotted to you or those entrusted to you or those in your charge. And if you look at that definition toward the bottom of page 8, the first meaning in the New Testament is a lot. They cast lots for Jesus' garment. But then he goes on to say in that second sentence, the main sense is an allotted portion. And this is the term that we go back to the book of Joshua, where God said, "You're going to appoint or allot to Israel. Each parcel that they receive will be given by lot." So each individual got his particular inheritance, and that was allotted to him. That was the inheritance that was allotted to him, and that. Outside of Joshua, that's pretty much how the word is used. When the word lot is used, it means what you were allotted. The only other use of the term in the Old Testament is the Urim and the Thummim, because they were lots. In other words, if you pulled this one out, it meant yes. If you pulled this one out, it meant no. So basically, God made his will known to the people back then through this Urim and the Thummim. But other than that, And there's no way in this particular context that it could be talking about the casting of Lot. So if we turn to page 9, I've got a couple of charts there that you can look at, because each eldership has a charge. And so in Acts chapter 20, verse 28, right at the top of page 9, it says, "Take heed to yourselves, to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you bishop." So all the flock among which, and there's that Greek word "and" again, which means in the midst of or among. So the congregation in Ephesus appointed the elders that are in Ephesus, and that was the flock that they had been that had been allotted to them. And so in Acts 14:23, they appointed elders in every church. Well, every church where they appointed elders is the charge allotted to them. That was what God gave them by lot. When he appointed them in that church, that's what they were over. And I think you could make an interesting application. I was hoping Billy was going to be on tonight. I wanted to talk to him a little bit about this. But when Ahab wanted to take Naboth's vineyard, Naboth said, "The Lord forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you." Now, that's, the term inheritance here is the same concept as the lot. And so he was allotted that vineyard, and he said, "I cannot give that vineyard to you. It's from the Lord. It's the inheritance of my fathers." Well, the same thing is true. What Ahab wanted to do to Naboth is what these elders are wanting to do when they try to take authority away from another congregation. When they decide that they want more authority than the charge allotted to them, they're acting exactly the same way that that Ahab did with Naboth. He wanted something he had no right to have. And when these elders seek for a position or authority above and beyond that local congregation, they're doing the same thing that Ahab did. And so if you look at that second charge, you have the charge allotted to you, which is the flock among you or in your midst. So each of these circles represents a local church, and those shepherds who are over or involved in that local church, that's where their authority starts, and that's where it ends, and that's the charge that's been allotted to them. Without that, they don't have any right to do anything with that congregation. The only right that any group of men have is if the Holy Spirit has made them the overseers, and that is limited to the flock among which they were appointed. And so we're right back to church autonomy again. You see it in Acts 20, you see it in 1 Peter 5:2. Now we get it again here in verse 3. It's a charge allotted to you. And so when you get a Catholic church who puts an overseer over hundreds of congregations, well, that's what Ahab was wanting to do. That's following Ahab's example. And so none of us want to be like that, that the other congregation is the charge allotted to them, and our congregation is the charge allotted to us, or the lot that God has given. All right, anybody have any thoughts on that? On that analogy or that example? There's always greed for authority. There's always greed to have power. We have that expression, power corrupts, and it does. And so, unfortunately, that when Paul wrote those elders at Ephesus, which, by the way, are also in the audience of Peter's words here, because they were in Asia, and that was one of the provinces that Peter was writing to. So these elders in Ephesus have gotten this twice. And yet Paul said in Acts chapter 20, which was probably maybe 5 or 6 years before they got this letter, maybe a little more than that, men from among your own selves are going to arise and draw away the disciples after them. And of course, that all culminated with the Roman Catholic Church. And some of that started in Ephesus when one of the bishops put themselves over the others. He called himself the bishop, and then the rest of them were just presbyters or elders. And off we go to the races. Next thing you know, you've got bishops, cardinals, archbishops, popes, and all sorts of additions because power corrupts and people lust for that power. Okay. We can't be lords over that charge. Again, God was so strong in his condemnation of those shepherds in Ezekiel and those shepherds in Jeremiah. So the only authority that elders have are, number one, of course, the scriptures. If God says this is what you have to do, then they have to do it. But not as lords, but as submissive to Christ. But then there's this example. And this is the same word for type and antitype. I found it kind of interesting as I was going through it today. If you notice at the very bottom of page 9, this Greek word tupos, from which we get the word type, it occurs 15 times in the New Testament, and anti-tupos occurs twice. In secular Greek, tupos is used to describe the process of casting and forming, and it can refer either to something that's been cast or something that's been formed. So, turning then to page 10, we see that Jesus is the perfect example in every way, and we have to be cast. We have to imitate him. That's where Paul starts in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1. Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. So the imitation of Christ is where it starts. But then the elders need to become examples of Christ in such a way that people who love the Lord and who want to serve the Lord, they want to follow that. So we see the examples. I'm not going to read them all now, but on the middle of page 10, we have the different uses of this word. Remember, he said it was used 15 times. Well, here's a few of those examples. And I think the ones that I would like to look at is 1 Timothy 4:12, where it says, "Let no man despise your youth, but be an example to believers in word, conduct, love, spirit, faith, and purity." So here's a pretty good way for the elders to understand what their role would be. If Timothy is an evangelist, is to be an example in conduct, word, love, spirit, faith, and purity, then certainly the overseers would have even more of a responsibility. And the same thing in Titus. In all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. In doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned. Well, once again, that is a perfect way to describe how the elder should be functioning as this example. And then Paul's words in Philippians 3, "Join in following my example and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern." So hopefully these elders are so walking, and so the elders should be those that the congregation can note and follow them and follow that pattern. So instead of an eldership compelling, the eldership needs to lead the way and give the examples. Now, of course, that doesn't mean, you know, if a congregation has unruly members, well, that's not lording it when we rebuke, we reprove, rebuke, exhort, when we withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly. That's not lording it over. That's in submission to Christ. So the idea here is that we just don't get in the way. Whether we're an evangelist, whether we're a Christian, whether we are a shepherd in the Lord's church, we need to show people how to live and hope that they'll follow. As I said, Christianity is a voluntary religion, and there's no compulsion any step of the way. If you have to force someone, if you say, if you don't come to services every week, I'm going to beat you up, or I'm going to take you to court, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, that's lording it over. And even if they came, it wouldn't make any difference. That's not what the Lord wants. The Lord wants willing volunteers. And so the role of the eldership, the role of the shepherds, is to facilitate the growth and the interests of the sheep. It can't be done by lording over them. It can only be done by showing them, and hopefully, like Peter did in Acts 2, testifying and exhorting. And that's really what this is all about. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Would be to verse 4? Okay, on page 11, I've got two more charts. When the chief shepherd appears. Now, underneath that, I've got this verse. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Now, keep in mind, this is in the context of all those condemnations in verses 1 through 6 of those shepherds who weren't doing what they were supposed to do. So, that first chart, I will establish one shepherd over them, and then we have the one circle, I, the Lord, will be their God. Then we have the second circle, my servant David shall be their shepherd. Then we have those lower circles, which are the charge allotted to each individual group of shepherds. Then the second chart is this particular verse, Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd, and then all of the shepherds underneath are the ones who have been allotted a flock. And they were allotted a flock, and the Holy Spirit made them bishops over a flock based on those qualifications. When a congregation goes through the qualifications, chooses out their elders, they become Holy Spirit appointed overseers. But they understand something. There's one over them. We saw back in chapter 2 that Jesus is the bishop of our souls, which is the overseer of our souls. Now we see Jesus as the chief shepherd, and he's the one over. And as I said, you can't put anything between those shepherds, those lower shepherds, and Jesus. There's no authority, there's no missionary society, there's no sponsoring church eldership, there's no pope or any other governing board between the chief shepherd and his under shepherds. That's all there is. And so Jesus has expectations. I think that verse at the bottom of page 11, I'm the good shepherd. Good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. All right, well, there's a pattern. And that should be the attitude of all these under-shepherds. They too should be willing to lay aside anything in their life for the sheep. And then he talks about the hireling. That's what Peter's just finished saying. Don't be doing this out of compulsion. Don't be doing this for filthy lucre or for money. You don't want to be a hireling. You want to be a passionate shepherd who cares for the sheep. One who doesn't own the sheep sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. Well, that's how God condemned the people in Ezekiel. And so the hireling flees because he's a hireling. Well, he's a hireling because he does it out of compulsion. He doesn't do it willingly. And so Peter's trying to protect the shepherds. Peter's trying to protect the sheep. If the sheep don't have shepherds who are doing these things, then they don't have qualified shepherds. And if they don't have those qualified shepherds, then the rest of the sheep have to step up. The rest of the sheep have to have the same passion for the other sheep and care and concern. They can't be elders. They can't function as elders, but the work still has to be done. Somebody has to be out there doing these things. If you don't have elders, you still have to withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly, and you still have to go out and take care of the ones that need help, the ones that are broken, the ones that are lost, the ones that have wandered away. Somebody's got to be doing all this. And hopefully, the people who are doing it are the ones that will ultimately become the shepherds of the congregation. Anybody have any comments or thoughts or ideas on that? Okay, well then let's turn to the last page. You will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. It's interesting that he ends the book almost exactly the way he started it. I've got that verse there at the very top of page 12. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to his abundant mercy, has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. Well, now we've come back to that. Now we have a crown of glory that does not fade away. I don't think the Lord here is trying to imply that the elders are going to get a different crown or a greater crown than everyone else. It's just to whom much is given, much is expected. But you can see at the very bottom of page 12 that that imperishable crown is for all Christians. And the crown of righteousness that Paul is saying, he says, it's not just for me, but for all who love his appearing. And the man who endures in temptation is going to receive the crown of life. And so Jesus said, every one of you who will be faithful unto death will receive the crown of life. And then he tells the people in, I believe it's in Philadelphia, I'm coming quickly, hold fast what you have that no one may take your crown. So I don't think the elders here are getting something that the rest of us are not getting. I think that all of us are going to receive that crown depending on our gifts. Remember in Romans chapter 12, and of course in Philippians or 1 Peter chapter 4, he's already dealt with this, that as God, each has been given a gift, we need to minister it among ourselves. And so whether I'm giving a cup of cold water, Jesus said, if you give a cup of cold water, you're going to get the crown of glory. If you stay faithful until death, if you're an eldership that is doing the work that needs to be done, whatever capacity we choose to serve the Lord. And remember, James said this, don't be many of you teachers, because you're going to receive a heavier judgment. So the responsibilities can become more difficult, but the reward is the same for everybody. And so it's not, I don't think he's saying here that elders are going to get a better crown than anyone else. I think that the point is we're all going to get this crown of glory. But if you're an evangelist, if you're a watchman, if you're a shepherd, if you're a wife, if you're a husband, they're all going to be the same crown, but the way we get it will be slightly different depending on the role that we're in. Right, well, that pretty well covers the eldership, so we will now be able to close this chapter. I hope this has been helpful to all of us. It's just really important that we understand all these things to protect ourselves from the false teaching and the false prophets and the grievous wolves that are out there. And this is just something we all need to understand. All right. Anybody have any other thoughts, questions, or comments, or ideas they'd like to put forth before we wind her down tonight?
Alan, I have a thought. You were talking about the crown of glory. I was looking through some of the references here on page 12, and it seemed like the definite article is used in regards to all of these, the crown of glory, the crown of life, the crown of righteousness. So I think that you're right on, that it isn't something that is, it could be said, a crown in the sense grammatically that there's many of them. It's, I don't want to take and say it, it's, when you run the race and you win, that the race of life to get into the kingdom, there's, in one sense, there's no place else to go. You got it. It's there. It's a crown of life.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what we're all struggling for, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the Lord has been very, very gracious to all of us to allot us the time that we have in this life to prepare ourselves. And if we don't, and we understand that we must, and we don't, then we're foolish. There's no question about it. So much time has to be spent in preparation. And we ought to be thankful for that time that it's allotted us. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree 100%. All right, then. That's all I have.